Hey everyone, welcome back to Daily Newsletter Digest. It's Sunday, May 10th, 2026, and wow, we've got a packed show today.
Yeah, this is one of those days where everything seems to be moving at once. AI agents, space business deals, credit card shakeups. Where do we even start?
Let's kick off with something that's probably going to hit a lot of our listeners directly, credit card news. Chase just announced they're killing the Sapphire Preferred's 10% anniversary bonus in October.
Wait, the anniversary bonus? That's the one where you get 10% back on all the points you earned that year, right?
Exactly. So if you earned 50,000 points in a year, you'd get an extra 5,000 points on your anniversary. They added that perk back in 2021, and now it's gone. Effective October 1st.
That's a pretty meaningful hit, especially for people who put a lot of spend on that card. I mean, if you're a heavy user, that could be thousands of points you're losing annually.
Right. And it was one of the things that differentiated the Sapphire Preferred from other travel cards. So this is a clear devaluation. At the same time, though, there's some other card movement happening. JetBlue just launched a massive sign-up bonus on their Premier card.
How massive are we talking?
100,000 points after you spend $5,000. They also added new benefits, a $300 travel credit, and a 15% points rebate. But here's the kicker. The annual fee is now $499.
Whoa. That's a serious annual fee. So you're really betting on using those JetBlue flights to justify it?
Absolutely. It's not a card you get casually. But if you're loyal to JetBlue and flying a few times a year, the math could work. Just not for everyone.
Yeah, and speaking of devaluations, wasn't there something with Bilt and Grubhub?
Oh yeah, this one's sneaky. Bilt changed how their $10 Grubhub reward works. It used to be issued as a gift card, which meant you could stack it with other promo codes and even accumulate multiple months' worth before using it.
That sounds way more valuable than just 10 bucks.
It was. Now it's just a promo code. You can't stack it, you can't save it up. So the actual value drops significantly, even though it's still called a $10 reward.
Classic loyalty program move. Change the fine print, keep the headline number the same.
Exactly. Okay, shifting gears. Let's talk markets and crypto, because there's some wild stuff happening in that world.
I saw the Layer Zero story. That was a mess.
Huge mess. So back on April 18th, there was a $292 million exploit on the Kelp DAO RS8EAS bridge. And for weeks, there was finger-pointing about whose fault it was. Well, Layer Zero just came out and admitted they screwed up.
What exactly did they do wrong?
They allowed their own validator to be the sole verifier on high-value transactions, what's called a 1-over-1 DVN setup. Basically, there was no backup check. It was Layer Zero verifying Layer Zero.
And KelpDAO had been publicly calling them out for deflecting blame?
Yep. Kelp accused them of blaming users for what was really an infrastructure failure. So Layer Zero eventually had to own it. This is actually notable because in crypto, it's rare for a major infrastructure provider to take direct responsibility for a loss this big.
Yeah, usually it's all not our problem, user error, read the docs. So that's actually refreshing in a depressing way.
Right. Meanwhile, on the more optimistic side of crypto, Ondo Finance had a huge week. The token surged 68% after the DTCC announced timelines for its tokenized securities pilot.
Wait, the DTCC, that's the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, right? The actual plumbing of the traditional finance system?
Exactly. They're the ones who settle almost all securities transactions in the US, and they named Ondo Finance as one of more than 50 firms in their working group. That's a massive stamp of legitimacy for the whole real-world asset tokenization space.
So institutions are actually serious about this now?
It sure looks that way. And then you've got the Telegram story with Toncoin. Pavel Durov announced that Telegram is basically taking over the open network and becoming its largest validator.
And the token more than doubled?
Yep, even though that's a pretty significant centralization move. But markets loved it, because now there's a clear entity driving the network forward.
Funny how crypto celebrates decentralization until a big company shows up and takes control, and then everyone cheers.
Human nature, I guess. Bitcoin, by the way, is hovering around $80,000. Spot ETFs had a rough day Thursday, $277.5 million in net outflows, which ended a five-day streak that had brought in about $1.69 billion.
So momentum stalled a bit.
Yeah, it's kind of stuck in this range. All right, let's jump into something really interesting, the space business. There were two massive deals in April that signal we're entering a new phase of the satellite economy.
This is the Rocket Lab and Amazon stuff, right?
Exactly. On April 14th, Rocket Lab completed its $155.3 million acquisition of Mynaric, which makes optical inter-satellite link terminals. And on the exact same day, Amazon announced an $11.6 billion acquisition of Globalstar at $90 a share. That's a 117% premium.
So Amazon now owns satellites and spectrum?
Yep. Globalstar gives them L-band and S-band spectrum, plus 24 LEO satellites. This is all for their direct-to-device strategy, basically letting regular smartphones connect directly to satellites.
And Rocket Lab buying Mynaric, why does that matter?
Because Mynaric makes the optical terminals that let satellites talk to each other at really high speeds. These are the lasers that connect the constellation together. And now there are only three independent suppliers left. Rocket Lab just became the only listed company that does launch, spacecraft, and optical terminals all vertically integrated.
So they're owning the whole stack.
Exactly. And here's the thing. The Space Development Agency just awarded $3.5 billion in contracts for 72 satellites in their Tranche 3 tracking layer. The SDA has standardized on optical inter-satellite links. So there's this massive production cycle starting, and the bottleneck is these optical terminals.
So whoever makes those terminals is in a really good position.
Right. And the newsletter we're reading from, PhotonCap, is arguing that the LEO satellite cycle has shifted from deployment to production, meaning it's not about launching a few demo satellites anymore, it's about building thousands of them at scale.
And they think the smart money is in the bottleneck components, not the launch vehicles.
Exactly. They're calling out radiation-hardened semiconductors and these optical terminals as the real alpha. Amazon's Kirkland facility is apparently set up to build about 1,000 satellites per year. That's production volume, not R&D.
This feels like the infrastructure build-out phase. Like when railroads were being laid in the 1800s, you wanted to own the steel and the rail ties, not necessarily the train companies.
Great analogy. And speaking of space infrastructure, AST SpaceMobile just got FCC approval for its 248-satellite direct-to-device constellation. They have to launch 124 satellites by August 2030, and the full 248 by 2033.
Didn't they just lose a satellite?
Yeah, Bluebird 7 ended up in a lower orbit than planned and is a total loss. But they expect a $30 million insurance claim. So it's not catastrophic for them, but definitely a setback.
Still, getting that FCC approval is huge. That means they can actually start offering commercial service.
Absolutely. Okay, let's pivot to AI, because there's a ton happening there too. Anthropic just released a 31-page guide on how to prompt Claude Opus 4.7, and apparently it requires totally different strategies than the previous version.
Wait, a 31-page prompting guide? That seems excessive.
It does. But the reason is that Claude 4.7 behaves very differently from 4.6. It's way more literal. It executes exactly what you type, doesn't try to infer what you meant.
So if you're vague, you get vague results.
Exactly. And it ignores negative instructions entirely. So if you say don't use jargon, it just doesn't process that. You have to say write in plain English. A 16-year-old could read aloud.
That's such a specific reframe.
It is. And there's another big change. Claude 4.7 uses something called adaptive thinking, which means extended reasoning isn't triggered by default. You have to explicitly tell it to think deeply.
How do you do that?
You just add think before answering, maximum reasoning, at the end of your prompt. That forces it into deep reasoning mode.
That's a handy trick. Is there like a cheat sheet for this stuff?
Actually, yeah. There's a free Claude skill you can download. It's basically a command you type, /47, and it automatically rewrites your lazy prompt into a fully optimized Claude 4.7 prompt with all the right formatting.
Okay, that's genuinely useful. We should link that in the show notes.
Definitely. And there's a bigger trend here. AI models are getting more literal and instruction-based as they scale. They're less like conversational partners and more like really powerful compilers. You have to be precise.
Which is kind of the opposite of what everyone thought AI would be, right? We thought it would get better at understanding us, not more pedantic.
Right, but it makes sense if you think about it. The more capable the model, the more it can do exactly what you ask. So you need to be clear about what you're asking for.
Fair point. What else is happening in AI?
There's this concept of physical AI that's starting to take off. NVIDIA's calling this the ChatGPT moment for robotics.
Physical AI, so like robots?
Robots, but also a lot more. Think smart factories, autonomous vehicles, delivery drones, AI camera systems, basically any AI that interacts with the physical world through sensors and actuators.
Okay, so it's not just humanoid robots walking around.
Right. In fact, the newsletter specifically warns against equating physical AI only with humanoid robots. A lot of the real business value is in less glamorous stuff, like Amazon's Vulcan robot, which already handles 75% of their million-plus item catalog.
That's actually pretty wild. 3/4 of everything Amazon sells can be handled by this robot.
Yep. And BMW has cars driving themselves off the assembly line through testing with no human driver at all. These aren't demos. These are production systems.
So this is already happening, not some future thing.
Correct. Counterpoint Research expects 145 million physical AI units to ship between 2025 and 2035. UBS projects 2 million humanoid robots in workplaces by 2035, scaling to 300 million by 2050.
Those are big numbers, but 2050 is still 24 years out.
True, but the ramp starts now, and the difference between old factory robots and physical AI is adaptability. Old robots failed if a screw shifted 2 inches or the lighting changed. Physical AI systems are designed to handle that variability.
So they're actually robust in real-world conditions, not just controlled environments?
Exactly. All right, staying on AI but shifting to practical tools, there's a new wave of AI productivity tools designed specifically for teams, not just individuals.
Like what?
One that caught my eye is called Crewbot. It's an AI agent platform that runs 24/7 and supports team collaboration with shared memory and workflows. It integrates with Slack, Teams, WhatsApp, Notion, basically all the places teams already work.
So it's not just a chatbot you talk to, it's actually embedded in your workflow.
Right. And the key thing is it's designed for teams, not individuals. So multiple people can share agents, share memory, share workflows. That's a big shift from most AI tools, which are very single-user focused.
What's the pricing on that?
There's a 7-day free trial. Then paid plans start at $49 a month.
Not bad if it's replacing or augmenting multiple team members' time.
Exactly. There's also a tool called WhisperFlow, which is AI voice dictation that converts natural speech into formatted text system-wide on your computer.
System-wide, so it works in any app?
Yep. Email, documents, Slack, whatever. The free plan gives you 2,000 words a week. Flow Pro starts at $12 a month annually.
That could be genuinely useful for people who think faster than they type, which is most people.
Right. And there's one more I want to mention, Claris. It's a browser extension for AI-powered YouTube summaries and Q&A. You can ask questions about a video, get transcripts, chapters, all that.
How much?
Early user pricing starts at $4.39 a month, or you can do a one-time lifetime payment of $79.
Lifetime for $79 is actually pretty compelling if you watch a lot of YouTube for work or learning.
Agreed. Okay, let's shift back to markets for a minute. There's this fascinating trend where retail investors are actually outperforming the professionals.
Wait, really? I thought retail investors were supposed to be dumb money.
That was the narrative. But Goldman Sachs' retail favorites basket gained 30.5% in 2024 versus the S&P 500's 16.4% rise. That's the third consecutive year retail has outperformed.
What are they buying?
Nvidia, Amazon, Reddit, AppLovin, Palantir, Tesla, basically high-growth tech and meme-adjacent stocks. And younger investors are driving this. JP Morgan data shows over 33% of 25-year-olds moved money into investing accounts in 2024, up from just 6% in 2015.
That's a massive shift. So a whole generation is getting into investing way earlier than their parents did.
Exactly. And a lot of them are waiting for SpaceX to go public. There are at least 170 special purpose vehicles set up since 2020, just to give retail investors indirect exposure to SpaceX. And it might IPO as soon as next month.
That would be huge. Everyone wants a piece of SpaceX.
Absolutely. But Warren Buffett had a cautionary note at Berkshire Hathaway's annual meeting. He said, "We've never had people in a more gambling mood than now," and specifically called out one-day options trading as speculation, not investing.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between buying and holding Nvidia and trading zero-day options on meme stocks.
For sure. And speaking of where people are putting money, alternative assets are having a moment. Rare collectibles are setting records.
Like what? Art?
Actually, traditional art only grew 4% last year. But collectibles like Pokemon cards, rare wines, vintage video games, even dinosaur fossils are going crazy. Logan Paul sold a Pikachu Illustrator card for $16.5 million in February.
$16.5 million for a Pokemon card.
Yep, a 1945 bottle of Domaine de la Romanée-Conti sold for $812,500 in March. That's up 46% from 8 years ago. And three nearly complete dinosaur fossils have each sold for over $30 million since 2020.
People are buying dinosaur bones as investments. What a time to be alive.
Right? And it makes sense in a way. These are volatility hedges. They're driven by nostalgia, and there's limited supply. You can't mint more vintage Pokemon cards.
True. Although I'm not sure I'd want my retirement savings tied up in fossils.
Fair. There's also this trend of family offices growing massively. Over 9,000 globally now, managing $3.1 trillion as of 2024. Deloitte forecasts they'll hit $5.4 trillion by 2030, which would surpass hedge funds.
Family offices. Those are the private wealth management firms for ultra-rich families, right?
Exactly. And they're increasingly doing their own deals, private investments, real estate, alongside traditional securities. They're not just passive allocators anymore.
Makes sense. If you have that much money, you can do your own due diligence and get direct deal flow.
Absolutely. And here's a fun one. There's a new ETF called the UFO Disclosure ETF, ticker UFOD.
You're kidding?
I'm not. It invests in aerospace and defense firms like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Palantir, framed around companies likely to benefit from commercialization of non-human technology.
So it's a UFO ETF that's actually just a normal aerospace and defense ETF?
Pretty much. The CEO even said the fund can exist without there being aliens, since the core holdings are solid companies regardless.
That's hilarious. It's brilliant marketing, though. You get the UFO crowd and the serious defense investors.
Exactly. Okay, one more thing before we wrap. There's this Substack post from a guy named Gavin McCracken about Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent allegedly keeping oil prices in a specific range.
Oh, I saw this floating around. Is there actual substance to it, or is it just conspiracy theory stuff?
Well, the author himself says he's finance illiterate, and that all his content should be assumed wrong and treated as entertainment only. So, take it with a massive grain of salt.
Okay, so what's the claim?
The claim is that Bessent has an easy-to-execute algorithm to keep oil prices range-bound between $80 and $120, and that the U.S. and its allies can maintain this longer than most people think.
And what's the mechanism? Or did he not explain that?
The excerpt doesn't fully detail it. He teases a geopolitical strategy targeting Iran's oil revenues, but specifics are withheld.
So it's basically a thesis with disclaimers piled on top of disclaimers.
Yeah. He did say he built an investment portfolio around the thesis, which he thinks has a reasonable probability of being robust and profitable. But again, huge disclaimers about total loss risk.
I mean, oil prices are set by global supply and demand, OPEC decisions, geopolitical events. The idea that the Treasury Secretary has a magic algorithm seems pretty far-fetched.
Agreed. Though governments do have tools, strategic reserves, sanctions, diplomatic pressure, whether that adds up to an algorithm is another question.
Right. Interesting theory, but I wouldn't bet my retirement on it.
Same. All right. Let's wrap up. Big day in AI with the Claude 4.7 prompting changes and physical AI ramping up. Space business is entering a production phase with Amazon and Rocket Lab making major moves. Retail investors are outperforming, collectibles are going wild, and credit cards are getting devalued left and right.
And apparently there's a UFO ETF now, so that's fun.
That too. As always, thanks for listening. If you want more details on any of these stories, check the show notes. We've got links to all the original sources. We'll be back tomorrow with whatever the world throws at us next.
See you then.